Our second case this morning is United States against Hunsinger. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Chief Judge and judges of this honorable court, may it please the court. Appellant possessed a personally owned laptop computer and a detachable hard drive while deployed to Iraq. He kept those items together in his barracks room. The barracks was a brick building with lockable doors. The record reflects that the chain of command did not have ready access to the rooms, as reflected by the fact that witnesses testified that the chain of command could not enter Terriman Boudreaux's rooms because the doors were locked and had to recall the soldiers to gain access to that particular items of computer equipment. And the witnesses testified that they were able to gain access to appellant's equipment because his roommate was there to let them in the room. The laptop was password protected. The detachable hard drive could not be used without a computer device. On these facts, the military judge concluded that no soldier at Forward Operating Base Loyalty held a reasonable expectation of privacy in their rooms.
Do we need to decide that to decide this case?
You do not, Your Honor. I would say that if there was no expectation of privacy, then the search would be reasonable. So, yes, this is a matter that this court must conclude contrary to the judge.
What if there's an expectation of privacy and there's probable cause?
Your Honor, that would not be sufficient because there's an illegal search in this case. Captain Miller testified that he searched both the detachable hard drive as well as...
You're talking about after the seizure?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's your...
Well, Your Honor, the seizure the actions of Captain Miller are important because they demonstrate that he never held a judicial mindset at any time. This court has held that the actions before the pre-search should be considered in light of the actions after the seizure. So, for example, in this case, you have a commander who orders equipment to be brought to him, and his first response is to immediately search the detachable hard drive.
Was there an objection at trial on the basis he wasn't neutral and detached?
There was not, Your Honor.
So why don't we look at this under plain error?
No, Your Honor. This court has stated that waiver does not apply in such a circumstance. And U.S. v. Rivera...
You mean forfeiture?
Well, yes, Your Honor, forfeiture. I believe this court talks in terms of waiver in the 1980 case, but yes, I understand the difference.
Yeah.
So in U.S. v. Rivera, this court held that when probable cause is properly raised at the trial level and there's no gaps in the record and all the facts are discernible, including the actions of the commander who authorized the search, as it is in this case, that the record is of ample sufficient factual basis for this court to decide the matter without an issue.
Counsel, which case are you relying on from this court for your assertion that we have held that a commander's post-search authorization actions can be equated back to his determination as to whether or not a search should be made initially?
Your Honor, both U.S. v. Ezell as well as U.S. v. Rivera, and this makes sense.
And I mean, did we say it there, or is that just part of the holding, or part of the fact pattern?
Your Honor, I can find the language, but I believe it's a... There are many holdings in that case. I would not view that as dicta. That arose from some of the circumstances in the underlying cases.
Well, why then, if a commander who admittedly is not a judicial officer and is not a trained attorney has facts presented to him or her and makes a determination which otherwise would be, and just assuming this, otherwise would be a valid probable cause determination, why then would a subsequent action by that individual invalidate the initial action?
Your Honor, because it demonstrates he never held a judicial mindset. So, but there's two things here.
But don't we evaluate it based on the facts that we have then? Don't we make the determination as to the facts and as to the basis for knowledge?
I think in U.S. v. Ezell, Your Honor, this court was providing very instructive language that when a person demonstrates after the fact no neutrality or involvement in law enforcement, that calls into question the entirety of their actions in the case. And in this particular case, let's recall that Captain Miller maintained close control of the inspection, of the investigation, from the very start. His own testimony was, I told him, the first sergeant, I wanted him to talk to Powell, get the statements, and talk to Specialist Parr, and get some statements, and then I wanted him to back brief me when I returned, and I would decide what we needed to do next.
He's a commander.
Yeah. Yes, indeed, Your Honor.
Is that what a commander's supposed to do?
Your Honor, no, it's not. Commanders are... Well,
so should he have said, and then, First Sergeant, you'll make all the decisions, and I'll go fishing?
Your Honor, if a commander wants to be involved in law enforcement, that is perfectly fine. But a commander who's involved in law enforcement may not authorize a probable cause search. It is too easy for a commander to seek authorization from a higher-level person in the chain of command or consult a JAG and...
What's a commander in a war zone supposed to do?
Your Honor...
Do you have a handy magistrate sitting around?
Your Honor, there are plenty of lawyers deployed into theater. We have two lawyers in every single combat brigade. And so access to a magistrate should never be a problem.
The rules permit a commander to authorize a search, right? You're not contesting that.
A neutral and detached commander, yes, Your Honor.
Where's neutral and detached come from?
Your Honor, it chases back to Johnson v. United States.
Okay. And is that neutral and detached as a commander or neutral and detached in what sense? We've picked up this quasi-judicial language, and one thing we know is a commander is not a judge.
Correct. U.S. v. Stuckey, this court held that commanders cannot equate constitutionally to a magistrate. Correct.
Right. They're not judges. So when we say neutral and detached, do we mean neutral and detached as a commander?
The language from this court...
Neutral and detached as an impartial justice of the New Jersey Supreme Court might be.
Your Honor, the language from this court's decision is that the commander must be severed and disengaged from law enforcement.
Counsel, which findings of fact do you take issue with in the military judge's findings and conclusions on the motion to suppress? Which are clearly erroneous?
Your Honor, one critical fact of finding by the judge is that First Sergeant Goodwater conducted a search of appellant's computer equipment. That can mislead one to believe that all Captain Miller is doing is double-checking probable cause. That is clearly erroneous. The First Sergeant expressly denied that he did any search of either the detachable hard drive or the laptop. And Captain Miller's own sworn testimony on multiple occasions it is very clear that he searched both items.
So finding of fact 8 where it says First Sergeant Goodwater took the accused computer and hard drive back to his office, that's not true?
Is that
portion of the sentence?
That part of the sentence is correct, yes.
What about he plugged the accused external hard drive into his own computer, is that true?
He denied that, Your Honor.
He denied that?
He did, yes.
And that's because... The reason that's important to you because it all relates back to trying to define what role the commander was playing.
Correct, Your Honor. Absolutely. Captain Miller was never neutral and detached in this case.
His... You have evidence of that absent your argument that he ultimately searches the computer.
Yes, Your Honor. He maintained close control of the investigation from the beginning. The only two things that Captain Miller did not do in this investigation...
But that may make him a commander, not a law enforcement official. What? I understand your search argument, but I don't understand why a commander taking close control of something means he's a law enforcement guy.
Your Honor, that's this case, that's this court's case law. When you're personally involved in the investigation, that is a per se disqualification.
You have to be personally involved. If you're going to authorize the search, you're personally involved. Are you suggesting you had a personal bias?
No, Your Honor. Personally involved in the investigation, not in a search authorization. There's a substantial difference between the two.
I mean, if he's the guy breaking the door down or... going in there and grabbing the thing.
Your Honor, this court has held that merely seeking information about an informant was participating in law enforcement activities that disqualified that particular commander. This court has held that the mere presence at the scene of the search can disqualify or should disqualify absent extraordinary circumstances.
See, my problem is I'm having trouble using your... You're putting the commander in a position where he can't authorize a search because he has to get it. If he's going to determine there's probable cause, he has to ask somebody a question or do something.
Well, again,
it sounds like you've frozen him.
No, Your Honor. If the frontline commander wants to be involved in law enforcement, then there are very easy means for him to secure a probable cause search authorization. This court has emphasized the need for training in U.S. v. Lopez on these particular matters. And the drafter's analysis to MRE 311 still cautions commanders that because of this inability to equate the commander constitutionally with a magistrate, that their actions will be closely scrutinized in this regard. So the law seems clear on this matter, and it's very easy for commanders to address.
Is the underlying purpose of the focus on the commander being neutral and detached and similar language designed to have that person equated to a judge or a magistrate, or is it designed to ensure, and there may be others in these two options, designed to ensure that the commander isn't reviewing his or her own work? That is, if a commander is involved in a law enforcement investigation to the point where the commander is a part of the information gathering process, that the commander will then evaluate his or her own work, that's one thing. If the commander is acting as a commander and directing people to provide him or her with information that the commander will then evaluate, that's something else. Why isn't the latter, that is, a commander who's involved in command, including all aspects of command that relate to discipline and law enforcement, not a problem so long as the commander is doing that command function of gathering information which he or she will evaluate, as opposed to being the one who's actually doing the investigation, that then the commander will evaluate his or her own credibility?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, as the Supreme Court stated in Johnson v. United States, the Fourth Amendment does not deny law enforcement support of usual inferences which reasonable people draw from evidence. Its protection requires a neutral and detached person to draw those inferences, rather than the officer engaged in the often competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime. And that's the difference. The difference is not so much...
Does that aspect of the Fourth Amendment apply with equal force in the military when we have commanders engaged in authorizing searches?
Yes, Your Honor.
When we understand that commanders will have disciplinary need to gather information for the functioning of their command?
Your Honor, there's no problem with the commander performing any of those functions, but this court has cautioned consistently through its case law that any commander that does participate in that competitive enterprise of law enforcement is disqualified from meeting the neutral and detached requirement.
Going back to this case then, putting aside the actions that were taken after the seizure, was this commander disqualified by anything that he did beforehand?
Your Honor, I think that that's a very close question. But for the illegal search, there would be a dearth of facts upon which to evaluate that. The facts that we do have, though, based on his own testimony, is that he was intent on doing the investigation. In fact, the military judge said the only reason he asked First Sergeant to take the initial statement from Parr was because the commander had to go on a mission and couldn't do it himself. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that's a fair implication of the judge's rulings. So when you look at this record, even before the illegal search, you have a commander that intends on conducting a law enforcement investigation.
If he had taken the information from Parr and decided that that was sufficient to cause probable cause, to establish probable cause, even if he had been incorrect, would that disqualify him in terms of being neutral and detached if that's what he was going to rely on?
Your Honor, if that was the entire facts in this case, I doubt that the judge would have sustained the motion to suppress, and I doubt that this court would have overturned the judge if those were the entire facts. Of course, here we have very different facts. I mean, we have a situation, not just the illegal search, but after the illegal search, he has a soldier brought to him who has then read his rights, and he immediately demands the password, compelled testimony from a person who just invoked the right to counsel. And then in response to that, in the presence of that particular soldier, he turns and then enters the password and searches the laptop.
Unless my colleagues have further questions on this particular aspect, could you address probable cause, assuming that there's no deficiency in the commander's status here?
Yes, Your Honor. Probable cause comes down to just a few facts in this case. The main fact, of course, is Parr's statement, which is at Joint Appendix 268, I believe. Other than this statement of Parr, he knows that one video has been exchanged between Parr and Powell. That video was held by the judge to consist of two naked toddlers running in the grass, apparently filmed from behind a wooden fence. That is not child pornography as a matter of law. The only file that was child pornography was located on Parr's computer alone, and it was a hidden file. Joint Appendix, page 35. Powell admits that Parr initially lied about the file that was exchanged. And then you have this statement of Parr. And this is probable cause. This is all we have. Do you download files from friends? Yes. What friends? Boudreaux, Taryn, Hunsinger, Sergeant First Class Powell. Did you know that you had child pornography on your computer? No, absolutely not. Do you know how it got there from who? No. Have you had any discussion of child pornography in the unit and who? No, not at all. Anything else you want me to know? Just so if we find out who it is, leave my name out. Do you know who might have downloaded pornography to your computer or hard drive? Maybe Hunsinger. Has Specialist Hunsinger ever mentioned he was interested in child pornography? No, never ever heard anybody say anything. This does not constitute probable cause. If you took this statement to a neutral and detached person, no reasonable person would review this and say that probable cause exists. And the only information he had beyond that was the hidden file of child pornography on Parr's computer, creating an incentive for Parr to shift blame to someone else. And in fact, he lied about his knowledge of the files to Sergeant First Class Powell.
It's not enough for probable cause because why?
Your Honor, it's lacking in any specificity. There is no issue as to timeliness, for example.
Well, let me just ask you this.
Yes, Your Honor.
There's no question that there was a hidden child pornography file on Parr's computer.
Correct, Your Honor.
And they did ask him who he shared his computer with, right?
Who he had exchanged files with, yes, Your Honor.
Who he had exchanged files with, and he gave them some specific names, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the appellant's name was one of the names?
Correct, Your Honor.
And so that's not specific because?
Well, Your Honor, in the context, he stated that he had merely exchanged files. What kind of files? Were they music files? Were they video files? Were they Word documents? How were they exchanged? Was it a USB key? Was it a CD-ROM? Was it by email? Other than exchanging files with friends, what else had he done with his computer? Had he downloaded anything from the internet? Had he used peer-to-peer software? There are more questions in this particular state of facts, that statement, than there are answers. And so on that basis, there simply can't be probable cause. And one key point is there's no information regarding timeliness. When had he exchanged files? It would make all the difference in the world if he said the last time he exchanged files with Specialist Hunsinger was 6 months ago. In fact, he states he doesn't know, he can't remember when he last exchanged files. Typically speaking, if you can't remember when was the last time you did something, it's probably been longer than a couple weeks at least, maybe a lot longer. So when those particular facts and actual questions are what you have to derive probable cause is lacking. And in no instance is appellant aware of a court case that held inevitable discovery when probable cause was so debatable.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity to rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. My name is Captain Stephanie Cooper, and along with Colonel Norman Allen, we represent the United States in this matter. The appellant's commander was a competent authority with sufficient probable cause to authorize the search and the seizure of appellant's hard drive and laptop. The military judge was not clearly erroneous in his findings of fact, nor did he abuse his discretion in denying the defense motion to suppress.
Does the record reflect whether the commander actually thought through the probable cause determination and consciously reached a conclusion that there was probable cause? And if not, is that relevant? Or does it matter, or whatever the right word is?
Your Honor, the commander did make in the record of trial, there's evidence that he did think through it and he did weigh the evidence when he states at Joint Appendix 115 that upon reviewing the evidence, he felt relatively confident that the evidence would be found in these three laptops.
And from that, you discern that he's gone through a probable cause analysis in his own mind?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because we presume judges know the law, so we presume a commander knows the law?
Your Honor, in this case, since probable cause is more than bare suspicion, but something less than preponderance of the evidence, the commander's relative confidence is more than the probable cause would require, more than bare suspicion. So based on that, the government does stand to believe that the commander did go through a probable cause review.
And from the government standpoint, does it matter?
Well, Your Honor,
under 315 command authorized searches, need there be anything in the record other than the statement, go search? It's a question.
No, Your Honor. There doesn't need to be anything more than that. In this case, we do have a little bit more than that, which is the relative confidence of the commander. However, this court has stated that the only requirement for the commander is that he must be capable of determining whether probable cause exists, which is in United States v. Logan. There's no mandate that the commander has to go through the analysis and explain his process of probable cause.
Okay, counsel, doesn't that create a problem for us? Because when we review for probable cause, I think we review under the same standards that we review when a magistrate grants probable cause. So the first thing we look at are the facts that were available to the commander, and we have those here. They're argued a little bit, but I think we have them. The second thing we look at is the veracity, reliability, and basis of knowledge of the individuals providing the information to the commander. What do we have in the record that supports that? Or, you know, can we make an assumption that the commander knows his people? I mean, I didn't see anything in the briefs. I haven't heard anything in argument yet. And that's an important criteria for us to look at.
Yes, Your Honor. And as you mentioned earlier in your question, the deference that is given to a commander is the same as a magistrate, which is abuse of discretion. So unless this commander abused his discretion in believing in Specialist Parr's statement and Sergeant Powell's oral statement and the First Sergeant's briefing, then his decision should not be overturned.
But don't we have to have something in the record somewhere that shows us why he believed those individuals were reliable?
Your Honor,
I mean, we already have some allegations that, you know, Parr initially denied having the video on his computer, and certainly there's an argument that he's trying to shift the blame because he obviously has a improper video on his computer. Now, those are the kind of things that enter into whether or not an individual is reliable and whether or not you should believe his allegations.
That's true, Your Honor. However, also in United States v. Logan, this court recognized that the truth-telling effect of a soldier when he's talking to members of his chain of command. When Specialist Parr spoke with First Sergeant, he admitted to having the child pornography. So when he was speaking to those members of his chain of command, maybe the fear factor went away and he admitted, yes, I found this, I deleted it, I was scared, which is why I didn't admit it to begin with. So there is no veracity issue here, or if there was and the commander considered that, then he believed Parr's statement, he believed what Sergeant Powell told him, and he saw the two videos on his own. Now, although one video, as appellant has mentioned, was suspected child pornography but does not meet the legal definition of it, the fact of the matter is this is what initiated the investigation. This is something that was a suspected offense that initiated it. And upon further investigation by the first sergeant, the other child pornography image, 13-year-old Russian girl, was found, which is unquestionably child pornography. The commander reviewed this. The commander reviewed the oral statements, the sworn statement of Specialist Parr, and both of the videos. He understood and he explained at Joint Appendix 115, the path of the child pornography from Sergeant Powell to Specialist Parr to the three implicated soldiers. And based on that, he did have probable cause to authorize the search and the seizure of those three laptops.
Why is the appellant's three-house metaphor well-founded or not? Do you recall the three-house metaphor?
The three houses for the drug busts, Your Honor?
That's right.
Well, the government would direct this court to Maryland v. Pringle, where the Supreme Court, upon an arrest, where the police officer pulled over a vehicle, three passengers or three people in the vehicle, and consent search by the driver uncovered cocaine. The police officer asked...
I was asking you about the three-house metaphor, not the three people in the car.
Well, Your Honor, there are metaphors on both sides.
I mean, so, when you're in a car, you got a defined space and so on. I'm asking you to respond to the appellant's three houses on the street metaphor.
And Your Honor, here, the commander did have specific enough probable cause. Out of all the soldiers in his unit, out of potentially, I'm guessing here because this isn't in the record, but a company may have 100 to 150 soldiers. His probable cause was limited to these three soldiers and to certain equipment within their possession. These three soldiers had been implicated by Specialist Parr, and there was enough evidence to authorize this search and seizure by the commander.
At what point do the numbers change and the probable cause dissipate in the government's view? What if Parr said, I was in a Liberty bar and someone was looking at porn, and who was in the bar? Well, 4th Platoon was there. They're having a tour party. Is that probable cause to search the computers of everybody in 4th Platoon?
Your Honor...
And if not, why not? And if so, why so?
The government believes that in that case where an entire platoon may have been implicated, more investigation would have been necessary. However, in a case like ours where only three soldiers out of an entire company are implicated, then and out of an entire forward operating base actually are implicated, then that is specific enough to warrant a probable cause search of those computers.
Why is the numbers important? Why are the numbers important? It seems that it helps to find that you're only violating two people's or three people's privacy rather than 32, but why does that change the probable cause analysis?
In this case, Your Honor, the commander believed that the contraband was possibly on all three laptops because all of those individuals had shared together, or they had shared with Specialist Parr, and Specialist Parr had the child pornography on his laptop. Then the commander had a belief that all three of those laptops may also have the contraband. It wasn't that one was guilty and the other two were innocent. The commander's belief, which was sufficient for probable cause, was that all three of them could have. And this was at Joint Appendix 115 when he states he believed the contraband would be found on all three laptops.
Well, what do we do about the commander participating in the search? I mean, in our prior cases have said that you know, that's not proper. The commander shouldn't be there, shouldn't be present, and certainly shouldn't participate in the search, and that does give an indication that they are no longer unbiased and detached.
Here, Your Honor, the commander did not participate in the search.
Well, he did participate in the search once the computer was brought to Sergeant Goodwater's room, I guess.
The search and the seizure, Your Honor, took place prior to... The search and the seizure took place upon the commander's probable cause when the first sergeant went into appellant's room, searched the room, and seized his laptop and hard drive.
But when he brought it back, the commander did search both the computer and the hard drive.
Yes, sir. And the subsequent viewing of the evidence on the hard drive and the laptop is nothing more than his double-checking his probable cause, as this court in United States v. Hall recognized.
Well, you made that argument in your brief. But where in the record did he say that? I mean, what you're doing is you're taking a prior holding of this court where we've said, you know, he's double-checking it and didn't want to embarrass him or whatever that was, and now you're equating that to him. Where in the record do we get that?
Your Honor, at Joint Appendix 232, the commander stated that when he watched one of the videos on the hard drive, he did it just to make sure of what we were looking at. So that's where the government believes he is stating it's a fair interpretation of his double-checking his PC.
Why isn't he making sure what he's looking at for purposes of deciding what kind of disciplinary action to take?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Why isn't he looking at it to decide what kind of disciplinary action he's going to take as a commander? And why is the government at all hesitant to say it was perfectly appropriate. I'm not suggesting that is or is not, but in light of what you've said before about the commander's role, what would have been wrong with the commander looking at it for law enforcement and disciplinary purposes once it was seized?
Well, Your Honor, there is a dual-hatted, the commander has dual hats. Under RCM 303, one thing that this court has recognized in discussing with the defense counsel is that the commander has a duty to make or create an inquiry, a commander's inquiry, when he believes there's been a suspected offense. And on the other side, in MRE 315 D1, he can act as a magistrate and authorize a probable cause search. This court recognized in U.S. v. Stagg, as well as United States v. Ezell, that the commander, that these, it has incorporated these two together, finding that the commander can direct the investigation, however, he cannot become personally involved in gathering the evidence. So the issue is the impartiality of the commander. That's what it comes down to, and whether his subsequent viewing of this evidence makes him impartial in his original probable cause search and seizure. However, his subsequent viewing of that evidence, his subsequent actions, does not invalidate the initial probable cause that he had.
When do we measure neutrality and detachedness? As of what?
Can you say that again, sir? I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
As of when do we require neutrality?
In this
As of the authorization of the search? As of some later time? What?
Your Honor, in this case, we draw the line after the laptop and the hard drive were... After the appellant's room was searched, the laptop and hard drive were seized and were placed in the commander's lawful possession. At that point, the probable cause search is over, and the probable cause was sufficient. That's where we draw the line.
So now, then your answer to my question is, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting, your answer is, in this particular case, assuming that the commander looked at the material for law enforcement and disciplinary purposes, that's okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It is, because it doesn't affect his impartiality at the point that he determined there was probable cause for the search and seizure. The commander was not involved in any stage of the gathering of evidence. He, at Joint Appendix 86, is the only time he discusses what he did while he was out on mission. He wasn't even on the FOB to conduct the investigation. And he radioed to the first sergeant once to advise him that Sergeant Powell would be coming to talk to him and to initiate an investigation, telling the first sergeant to initiate the investigation. And the second time, also at Joint Appendix 86, where he radioed and he said, get statements. When I come back, we'll discuss. I'll look at them. You can brief me. So this was directing the investigation to some extent, but it was not becoming personally involved in gathering evidence. Therefore, it does not affect the impartiality of the commander up to the point where he said, go get those laptops and hard drives. Even if this
I'm,
court
I'm trying to figure out, as per some of the other questions, where to draw the line, if at all, with respect to the type of information that was at issue here. You suggested that if the informant or the person making the statement in this case had said, everybody in my platoon shares files, more information would be required before a search or seizure of each one of those computers would be authorized. What's the reason for distinguishing that case from the one we have before us?
Well, Your Honor, for probable cause analysis, there is a level of specificity that has to be met. And in that hypothetical, a platoon level, a platoon of maybe 30 or 40 soldiers, I believe would not be specific enough to warrant a probable cause search of each one of their laptops.
But wasn't your argument that the commander then had reasonable belief that, not that it was in one place, but it was in each of the three places? Why wouldn't the commander, under your theory, have a reasonable belief that it's in each of the multitude of places identified as potential fire sharers? Actual file sharers.
If we're talking about child pornography in that case, in the hypothetical, Your Honor, then I agree that he could have had a very reasonable belief that the child pornography, if all of those individuals, if each single one of them had shared, then he would have had a reasonable belief that all of them could have had the child pornography.
And then why, under your theory, couldn't he search and seize all of them? We're not talking about an inspection now. We're talking about a search.
Right. Well, Your Honor, I think he could then. However, the only reason I answered that to begin with is because I wasn't aware that we were talking about child pornography. I thought we were talking about probable cause in general.
Okay. And why is it different?
Your Honor, it's different because child pornography can be easily transferred and passed amongst the laptops and the hard drives, which is what happened in this case. So it's reasonable to assume that if one soldier has child pornography on his hard drive and he subsequently goes around to 30 other people and shares his music with them, they all may also have child pornography unknowingly on their laptops or hard drives.
So everybody who is part of a file-sharing system then is the subject of a probable cause search if one person has child pornography on it?
Well, Your Honor, of course, there has to be some ceiling on it. However,
where's the ceiling? It's not a platoon, apparently.
What I can say, Your Honor, is in this case, we haven't reached the ceiling.
Okay.
Any laptops and hard drives are specific enough. Even if this court were to find issue with the commander's probable cause search, the evidence is still admissible since the inevitable discovery doctrine applies. The Supreme Court adopted this doctrine in Nix v. Williams, and moreover, in recent cases, such as Hudson v. Michigan, the Supreme Court has noted the need for caution in applying the exclusionary rule, stating that suppression should be the last resort. This court adopted the inevitable discovery doctrine, United States v. Kozak, giving us a test for under a preponderance of the evidence standard, the government must prove basically two things, that government agents possessed or were actively pursuing evidence or leads that would have inevitably led to the discovery, and second, that the evidence would inevitably have been discovered in a lawful manner. Here, the government did possess the evidence and the leads that would have inevitably led to that discovery. Again, we look at the oral statement of Sergeant Powell, the written statement of Specialist Parr, the path to the three possible suspects, the possible implicated suspects in the transfer of the child pornography, the two videos, and the consent from the other two implicated soldiers that ultimately revealed no child pornography at Joint Appendix 68. And finally, the lawful seizure of appellant's equipment. So ultimately, probable cause for the search and seizure of appellant's laptop and hard drive was completely independent of the allegedly illegal search of the commander after the fact. Looking to the second prong from Kozak, the evidence would have been discovered in a lawful manner in two steps. First, CID's involvement, and secondly, CID's either request for consent to search to the appellant or their magistrate authorization. Once the equipment was in the hands of CID, they couldn't just turn on the computer or plug in the hard drive and look at it. CID, in their investigation leading to potential prosecution, would have had to either get consent from the appellant or get a warrant from a magistrate to search that laptop and hard drive. Therefore, there is a reasonable probability here that the evidence would have been discovered in a lawful manner had the alleged illegality not occurred. There are no further questions. May I conclude? The commander's probable cause search was lawful and proper. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the defense motion to suppress. Furthermore, the doctrine of inevitable discovery applies, and the evidence was admissible at trial. Finally, suppression should be the last resort. The government respectfully requests that this honorable court affirm the findings of the Army Court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Can I ask a quick threshold question? When you look at issue four, are you looking at the search for the computer or the search of the computer? One is the search in the dorm room, and the other is the search of the content of the computer by the captain.
Your Honor, just to be clear, by issue four, do you mean the probable cause assessment?
The way the wording of the issue is of.
Your Honor, the computer equipment itself is of no consequence. The evidence is data that's inside the computing equipment. So this is not a case where contraband is in plain view or is readily identifiable by its nature. Instead, this is a situation in which you must do some sort of search inside the computing device in order to discern whether or not there are any offensive files. If that answers your question, Your Honor.
Yes, thank you.
Your Honor, Maryland v. Pringle is distinguishable on the basis that that court relied on the common criminal enterprise of the three participants. That case holds that it's reasonable under those facts and circumstances to find, infer a common criminal enterprise. The drug money was located in the drug department. That was where the actual suspect, the appellant, was seated. The drugs were found with the rear passenger, and of course the car owner owned the car. While the government has pointed out that the commander said he thought he might find it on all three computers, that's not supported by either probable cause or any other facts in the record. And in fact, the judge concluded that the commander would either find it on one or the other two, one of the three. And that is the basis for the analysis done by the Army Court as well in their 33% assessment. The commander did not state that he knew the legal standard. In fact, he stated he did not know the legal standard. And so that is goes to his competency, which this court, U.S. v. Lopez, pointed out, citing Shadwick v. Tampa, that you must not only be neutral detached, but you must also be competent. The larger point, though, is any person who has a judicial mindset that intends to authorize probable cause can be certain to discern the legal standard before they reach that weighted decision. And then as two final points, this commander did have easy access to a legal advisor as well as CID. He actually testified that he consulted with a JAG or met with a JAG after all of these occurrences, either later that night or the next morning, and similarly had easy, ready access to CID as well. There were very easy steps for this commander to take. And then finally, there are five reasons why inevitable discovery does not apply in this case. There was no independent or parallel investigation that would have inevitably resulted. There was no testimony of any routine police practices that would have inevitably resulted in discovery. There was no other exception to the Fourth Amendment that applied to these facts and circumstances. There was no testimony or evidence by anyone involved in this case that they even considered seeking a warrant, much less would have inevitably have secured one. And then, as I stated before, Pelham is aware of no cases in which inevitable discovery was applied in circumstances in which probable cause was so debatable.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. We thank both counsel for your presentation today, and the court will stand in recess pending further order of the court.